Eric!
Hey, Charles.
How are you, man?
I'm good.
So we have a really interesting allotment of characters here.
Yes, that's what we're trying to do here at Lang.next, because there's many languages here, and many different languages, but language people always like to mingle with other language people, even if they don't like each other's languages, because we all like languages.
Yeah.
Right, so what we have here is we have two D people, the D language, and two Haskell people.
Yes.
So it's like native versus pure. And
ooh.
Let's see who wins.
Okay, so that's the topic.
Yes.
All right, so let's let people introduce themselves.
Yes, let's go ahead.
Walter?
I'm Walter Bright from Digital Mars, and I work on the D programming language compiler and the design of the language.
I'm Andy Adams Moran. I'm one of the founders of Galois. And I do, these days, mostly development, which is awesome fun. So, because it's all in Haskell, except for the C. And the Perl and the JavaScript.
All right, he already stole my thunder here. I'm Andre Alexandrescu. In my free time, I work on D with Walter. Outside my free time, I work at Facebook on mostly machine learning and their C++ code base.
Excellent.
Cool. Like, if D is so wonderful, why kind of haven't you convinced the kind of, you know, your bosses at Facebook to use D instead of C++?
Excellent question. D has had an interesting evolution as of late. At Facebook, the main matter is interacting within a large ecosystem of many, many machines, of which number I'm not allowed to disclose. But many, many machines, many, many zeros after the significant digit. And the problem there is interoperability across many machines, and that means things like thrift bindings and such. It also, of course, means social support from within Facebook. And we have a fair amount, actually, surprisingly so, I would even say. Because who's a prophet in their country? It just so happens that Facebook, there is, however, interest in D. And thrift bindings are just made it last week into the Apache code base. Congratulations to David Nadlinger. So I think things are on looking up. There's interest. People are looking at it. They're willing to try D on the first project that's going to be amenable to using that language. And stay tuned. The original poster is going to deliver.
Okay, good. Well, so because like you mentioned a very interesting point that, you know, there's a social aspect to kind of, you know, programming languages, and maybe it's not even social. It's like, you know, can you hire enough people that kind of know that?
Mm-hmm.
So what about Haskell? I always joke that, you know, if you put all Haskell programmers in an airplane, it probably fits in a Cessna. And if it would crash, nobody would even notice, right? So so how do we deal with that, you know, with Haskell?
The world shortage of Haskell programmers, like I said, worse than oil shortage?
No, it's not. Actually, we find that there's more and more Haskell programmers every year.
But is it exponential growth? Or?
You never know. It's, at the other point, you can't
tell. At this stage, it's still so early.
Are you one of the founders?
If you think about, I actually credit Simon PJ and Simon Marlowe in particular for their leadership of the Haskell community, because they've, even since like the early 90s, they've tried very hard to make it an open and welcoming place.
And so, by the way, Microsoft is really funding Haskell,
right.
Yeah?
That's right. And Microsoft, I think, because of that, because of the funding that they've been giving the Simons, and then, you know, now through like Well-Typed and those guys, we have a really stable Haskell. Microsoft deserves a lot of thanks for that, so thank you, Microsoft, very much. But getting back to finding Haskellers, there's been this, it does feel like an exponential growth, an explosive growth in the number of people who are just interested in Haskell. And then it doesn't take much for someone young and bright to move like interest into like expertise. They like, so if it's the first programming language they encounter, or even the fifth, people just start to fall in love with it, and then it really seems to appeal to a certain kind of creative, abstract thinker. And luckily, that's the sort of people that really try to go.
So is that not in contradiction, abstract thinker and creative? Or?
Not at all. I think abstraction and creativity are two sides of the same coin. I really do. Because
nicely put.
Because without creativity, without abstraction, you can't sort of you can't understand something enough to be able to create a new variant of it, or a completely new thing. And you need to be able to see the important structures of something in order to be able and understand the rules in that, in order to then be able to play with more freedom and creativity.
Are you sure? Because lots of times creativity comes from people who don't know what they're doing and don't know that they can't do that, but they wind up finding a way.
I think that's true. But then you get, but in the Haskell community, those folks tend to write these really bizarre libraries that get worked on for years and years and end up turning into something great. You know? So I think it's hard to say whether. Whether creativity depends on understanding or not. So I guess that's the point that you were making.
Well, it's also, a lot of creativity is breaking the rules. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you get so used to doing something a certain way, you know what the rules are, you know it's impossible, you know that something another way can't be done, so it doesn't even enter your mind, whereas somebody young coming in doesn't know that this isn't going to work, and they try it anyway, and make it work.
Yeah, I think that's why I think when that arises, that happens in Haskell, but in a different way. So, like when Eric and I were coming up in Haskell, we were almost embarrassed to say,
"You're pretty good."
But then the next generation of just amazing Haskell programmers like the Don Stewarts and the Ian Liners and the Duncan Cootses of the world. And also my fantastic colleagues at Galois, they came into it going, oh, yeah, of course this is the way you want to do it, because it's really fun and lovely. And they never had this sort of stigma of, feeling, I always felt beaten down about, FP is lovely, but no one really likes it.
Yeah, people were always laughing at us. Yes, we were bullied on the playground.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And in fact, it's one of the things that was an impetus for us in starting Galois was, we were sick of going to these languages conferences and hearing everybody complain about, industry won't use our ideas. And we decided, well, instead of just complaining about it, let's just actually try and do it, try and use our ideas. And I think that's been...
Where does kind of D come from? So often people say when you build something new or some software, it's like you have an itch to scratch.
Yep.
So what is the itch that D scratches?
The itch that D scratches is in the middle of a triangle. The triangle being built by the tension between the forces of efficiency and convenience and safety, right? So very often a language starts from some, essentially builds a position around one corner of this triangle, mm-hmm. and then tries to essentially achieve as much of the territory in the real estate of that triangle as possible. And with D, we figure that a lot of these tensions can be much more elegantly resolved by actually committing to the middle of the triangle, if you wish, the center of mass of the triangle. And of course, there's many other dimensions. So the triangle simplifies the design space quite crudely. So D wants to be a language that, for example, unlike Haskell, no offense intended, I'm sure not taken.
We're used to it, so.
Haskell is essentially has committed early on lazy evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so on no mutability. So it has committed from day one to certain tenets, and it draws both liabilities and advantages from mm-hmm. that stance. Mm-hmm. Right, indeed we have tried to avoid such extremely strong tenets. That's not to mean these unprincipled. It's simply to mean that D recognizes that there are multiple needs that people have in an application, and sometimes mutation might be the best approach, and sometimes laziness is the best approach, and it does allow for lazy computation. You know, very much inspired by Haskell's style. We were just talking earlier today about the clever Fibonacci Haskell implementation that's constant space and linear time, as it should. And actually, the D implementation of that essentially borrows very much from the Haskell way. It allocates exactly as much space as needed, constant amount, and then it proceeds in a very similar manner to the Haskell implementation. So D is an attempt to offer at the same time several good, desirable features. Among these, convenience, efficiency, and safety.
So you're trying to disprove the kind of cap theorem of programming languages, so to speak.
Right.
So Andy, Andrew, what shall I call you?
Kind of Andy's great. Andy's great.
But that was like the old name. I don't know. Nowadays you're kind of
It shouldn't say Andrew on here.
Okay.
I'm generally an Andy.
Yes. Okay. Good. So one of the things is that people often think that Haskell is slow, but then you know you read some of these kind of shootouts, and then Haskell wins. Where's the truth? Are these kind of cooked up benchmarks?
They're not cooked up. But if you look at the code in those and a lot of those winning ones, it's not the sort of code that you would show to someone who's not been using Haskell for many, many years. Because it really, I mean, one of the things that is nice about modern Haskell is that it does give you the power to take off the straitjacket and get right down to, for example, unbox values. So a lot of the speed that comes out through the shootout is a lot of care is taken to make sure that you don't create any extra data at all. So there's all these unbox pairs and unbox ints and that sort of thing running around. But it's not necessarily the first program you'd write in Haskell to do those things.
Yeah. So you could say you're really writing assembly code in Haskell syntax, or?
Well, it's not quite that bad. It's more like you're probably writing a strongly typed version of C.
Okay.
But only in those little tiny bits, because you still have all the richness of Haskell all around it. So I think the real story about the performance for Haskell comes when you're dealing with complex systems that require real thought about the algorithms or the data structures or both usually that you're using. Such that if you were writing it in a lower level language, you wouldn't see the apparent structure that you need to in order to make these like algorithmic changes that give you the really profound asymptotic speedups and things like that. So that's what we've found, is that we generally we start off by writing down what we think of as the correct thing, and then we work on getting it right, and then we think about performance after that.
So one of the things that, why I like Haskell and also why I don't like it, is that it feels very much like playing Tetris. So, you know, you write this thing that's obviously correct, and then you see, you know, a way to kind of, you know, condense it.
Yes.
And then you can see a way, and it just never stops. And in the end, you get this kind of, word salad kind of, that looks like Perl.
Yeah, you have to be careful. During my talk, Andrew Black asked, why didn't you abstract this away or abstract that away? And he had a point that, we could have abstracted those things away. But like anything, you know, too much abstraction is not a good idea. I guess Matthias Verleisen might say that you have to be careful about a premature commitment to abstractions. just because, we have a guideline of not abstracting a control flow or kind of thing, unless there's at least three instances of it, right?
Yes, okay.
But you can very easily get to that sort of word soup where you've got all these abstract functions, massively polymorphic, and there's only one instantiation ever.
Yes.
And it's pointless. It's just...
Yes, and point free is pointless.
Point free is pointless often as well.
Yes.
Although it's a very satisfying way to write.
That is true. That's it. So is the D compiler written in D?
It's currently written in... as one of my colleagues have termed it, C++.
And then what is the next step, C, or is the next step D? Which kind of part of the half are you?
Well, the best practices in C++ has evolved since I wrote this, the C++ front end. And so it's a bit behind the times, it's a bit old-fashioned. But the reason it is written in that and not in D is because I always envision people being able to slice the front end off of the compiler and bolt it onto the back end of other compilers. And this
has turned out to be a very successful strategy
mm-hmm. because now we have three D compilers, one of which is the one where the back end I wrote, and then there's the one connected to the GNU compiler collection called GDC, and there's one connected to LLVM, which is the LDC project, and these are all managed by different teams. So I think it was the right decision because it enabled, you know, there to be a rich environment of decompilers. You know, some people prefer one code generator over another or one ecosystem over another, and by doing it this way, you know, I said in the earlier talk that, you know, C was the lingua franca of all that. Mm-hmm. Well, with that C interface, I can connect to all these other existing compilers and tools.
So one of the kind of, you know, hidden costs of doing a new language is that you need to build new libraries, new tools, IDEs, and so on. So how does that work for D? And then next thing is like, what do you do for Haskell? Mm-hmm. Or do you guys, are you kind of macho programmers and like, you know, Notepad is good enough? I must say I'm a pussy programmer. I have to have the kind of IntelliSense kind of, you know, at the dot.
It's work in progress. So you're making a very good point. There are a lot of hidden costs in starting with a new language, either coming from the research world like Haskell has, or from the let's say engineering world like D has. Mm-hmm. The way we've addressed these costs, we've gotten a lot better at it with time, and our basic approach has been to work on attracting people and opening the compiler and opening the participation to the standard library. By the way, so you know the compiler is written in C++, but as a compiler proper, the runtime library, garbage collector, and standard library are all written in pure D.
Okay.
So essentially, we are you know, we eat a bit of the mythical dog food there.
Yeah, there's no C code in the runtime library.
There's no C code. Yeah, there's the zip library, but that's sort of external. So, you know, essentially it's pure D, so to say. Although, you know, I wouldn't think of D as pure. All right, so, you know, it is 100%.
It's tasty dog food, and like the bland dog food.
Right, exactly. It's a bit spicy there. And so, yeah. Okay, so that being said, we're still missing a few key tools for comfortable, like for pussy programs like you and
wow,
he said so.
I agree.
Yes.
And that's not a bad word, I guess. So,
yeah.
Essentially, what we do there, we actually have two Google Summer of Code projects that are aimed straight at developing tools. We have a lot of work from one past Google Summer of Code incarnation last year. We have people who are interested in working on these projects, including Visual Studio integration and stuff. And essentially, you know, what's going to happen, it's going to be an interest-driven, community-driven, and sort of critical mass-driven kind of effort. I think it's entirely possible. The fact that the front end is open, is mm-hmm. Open sourced, helps a lot, because essentially it not only keeps the three compilers in sync on the same virtual specification, but also it keeps the tools in sync with the language development. So, you know, I'm hopeful. We're not there yet, but things are happening. And last but not least, Walter has opened just a few months ago the so-called Deimos project. So there's D, his company is Digital Mars. Mars has two moons, Phobos and Deimos. Phobos would be the standard library, and Deimos would be the second satellite, which allegedly has water on it and ice and whatnot. So Deimos would be sort of the integration layer with a host of C libraries. So essentially, people write declarations for the C function signatures for the C APIs. Yeah. Somebody just submitted SQL, Oracle SQL binding like just 2 days ago, literally. Okay. So you know, there's plenty of work in the area on expanding the tool set.
So one quick question, because D is a native language, and a lot of times people will have the assumption that if it's garbage collecting, it's not native, which of course is incorrect. Your garbage collector is based on what, right? It's not reference counting like in COM, is it?
No, it's not.
Or is it garbage collected like .NET and CLR?
It's, let's say, non-reference counted. It's a mark and sweep garbage collection.
Okay.
You know, we know for a fact that using reference counting transparently is not going to work. So I know because I measured in a variety of other systems. Essentially, once programs get to a sufficient complexity, there's going to be cycles. And you know, they're going to appear in really weird ways that people cannot really predict. Mm. And essentially for simple programs or coarse-grained objects like COM objects, when you create a COM object, it's sort of a big deal. Say, you know, you create a factory, you call the factory, you do the query million interfaces, whatnot. So it's a big deal, right? It's huffing and puffing, right? So you huff and puff, you know, destroy the, you know, create an object. It's a big deal, right? It's like building a house. It's not casual. And that works for COM exactly because it's not casual, mm-hmm. so people tend to be careful about the way they instantiate right. and interlink these objects. Mm-hmm. Whereas in casual, let's say more casual programming, you tend to create objects without even so much as thinking about it, and those are going to inevitably create complex graphs and you know complex interactions. So you need a true garbage collector.
Interesting. Yeah. So Andy, so like you know like. When I was kind of still a Haskell programmer, we had hooks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was like a kind of a REPL loop kind of. Mm-hmm. You know, but has the kind of Haskell IDEs evolved since
well,
then?
Well, GHCI has a couple of extra features beyond what hugs had, including a very simple step debugger these days. But I think
so you're saying you can debug Haskell programs?
No, you shouldn't need to.
You would start with the correct thing and then you would refactor them and right, now you're saying you want to debug.
Oh, you're debugging your design.
Oh, you're debugging your design.
It's a very important distinction. but I know that there were at least two attempts to make Visual Haskell, like a Visual Studio plugins for Haskell. I don't know what they were like. I know that Dan Leyen worked on one for a long time and had a lot of trouble with trying to get the incremental parsing, incremental type checking to sync. And that's one of the problems with a lot of these IDEs, the bigger IDEs, is that they expect your language to sort of fit into their sort of style of thinking about languages.
Okay, but let me interrupt here because that's a kind of actually a good point. So one of the things that you know when you look at like a lot of compiler books, you know, or the academic work or, about parser and parser mm-hmm. combinators, in practice they're actually quite useless because in an IDE usually your program is in an incorrect state, but you still want to kind of be able to manipulate that.
Yeah.
So, like, how do you deal with that in D, or do you have like a traditional batch compiler? What Andy was saying is like, you know, you go through it. If there's a syntax error, you give up.
Well, D is a traditional batch compiler. You run it from the command line, and it runs compiles your program and gives you it either works or gives you a list of faults that you need to fix in your source code. That doesn't mean that you can't build an IDE thing. It's actually designed to make that much more straightforward than in some other languages. But what I work on is the batch compiler.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So I would, if I could, I would retract all my stuff on parser combinators because it gives people the kind of illusion that you know you write a parser kind of you know that parses the string from begin to end. Whereas I think the whole point is you have to kind of, you know, produce something even though there's errors, not even syntactic errors, but
so I think and there was also some work. There is, I think, still an Eclipse plugin for Haskell, and I have no idea what that's like. So basically, my IDE is Vim.
Oh, good, you're an LVI guy, I second. So are you guys VI guys or are you Emacs guys?
Well,
Notepad +++.
I use a heavily customized editor that I got acquired in the 1980s. Wow. And nobody else in the world uses it. Nobody else wants
it. Is it ED or?
No, it's a heavily modified version of Micro Remix.
Okay.
And modified by you?
Modified by me and Bjorn Freeman Benson and a few other people. Wow. And instead of having like a embedded scripting language to change the editor behavior, I just go and change the code to make it do what I want. So, and I like it because it's real simple to port from platform to platform, so it's always there.
And so what's your favorite editor?
Quite honest, I think all these, I'm sorry, I think all these debates are kind of silly, which is the editor and stuff, and you know, I think this is child. I was in high school, or you know, what's going on? Of course Emacs is the best.
Good one. I was scared, man. I thought you were really going to destroy it.
Yes.
Nice. So what do you use, Eric? Well, you're asking everybody else.
It has to have IntelliSense, right?
It has to have IntelliSense.
Oh, it's a P.
I'm a Kill Bill programmer. Maybe okay. That's better, right? Kill Bill 2 programmer.
There you go. He uses an IPD.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I'm like, LinkPad is at this point my favorite.
That's great.
And LinkPad, I cannot kind of praise LinkPad enough. And then of course I use Visual Studio as well, but you know, for like little kind of interactive you know, experiments, more like a calculator. So LinkPad really gives you the kind of, you know, the feeling of hooks where you kind of do little things. And then I think like Visual Studio is more like GHC, you know, when you want to kind of, you know,
GHC is a very hugs like.
Yes, yeah. But now that's kind of, and this is what Roslyn, we will get that, you know, in C Sharp
and so on. And I can't remember the name of this package, but there is a current effort going on to write a nice Haskell IDE in Haskell. That also knows about Cabal and things like that.
So what is this Cabal thing?
Right.
And the Haskell guys, like everybody was doing GitHub, and then Haskell people were doing, you know, Mercurial or what was it?
I don't know what it went. Darks.
Darks, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
The
Darks, written
Darks
in
is a one. Yes, and it's a wonderful, wonderful piece of software. But it really doesn't scale. When you have a long-lived source tree, having a highly flexible commutative algebra for patches can be a real problem. It can take you a long time to work out what the right patches to apply are.
Yeah, so. But maybe it's optimized for Haskell programs that are short and short-lived.
Yeah. So I think the biggest repo that uses Darks still is GHC.
Oh, I thought that that was switched.
Well, there's a bit of both, but then we also find that Cabal is there, so it's basically our RPM or whatever. It's
NPM,
our package manager. Yeah, it's our package manager, and it's actually in technological sense, apart from the fact that GHC has been improving out of sight in the last 5 years, especially in terms of optimizations and speed and that sort of thing, and footprint. You know. Without Cabal and the associated hackage database of packages, we wouldn't have grown the community as quickly and as largely as we have, because now we've got this very easy way for people to contribute packages and use packages and all this sort of thing.
Yeah. So how does that work for D? Because that is true. It's like, if I look back in the last 10 years, what has really changed in the software community is the ease as which you can get like other software, right? Like, you know, on .NET, it's like NuGet, you kind of right click in Visual Studio and, you know, you get it. And like Haskell has Cabal. Do you have something in D like that too, to make it really easy for people to contribute and to consume as well? Maybe that's more important even, right? To reduce all the friction of consumption.
Actually, we recognize that this is an essential artifact of a good, dependable programming language environment. It's work in progress. So right now we don't have a complete head-to-toe solution that, you know, you right-click in somewhere and it just happens. There is work on package distribution systems, and there's sort of in the community there's discussion about what's the best way. Each platform should have its own method. You use the native platforms method, like you know Yum on Debian systems versus MSI on Windows and whatnot. All of that versus building something in D and for D that, you know, sort of like Cabal, right? Mm-hmm. that downloads, installs, manages packages and dependencies and versioning. We haven't zeroed in on a complete solution yet. Right now, things are in terms of downloading packages and libraries, pretty much seat of the pants. However, we are working. You know, we do recognize this as an important topic, and you know, needless to say, it's been an absolutely huge success for the compiler. I'm not sure. So the source of the Haskell compiler is also open source, right? For us, it's been open. The front end has been open source for a long time, and it was just out there, and people tried to contribute, and that didn't happen because the process of contribution was extremely tedious, and the process of integrating contributions via like manually revising and merging patches was also extremely tedious. And we had Walter as a unique point of, you know, a dependency not there. Excuse me. So, you know, since 2 years ago, well, 1.5 years ago, we open sourced, we moved from SVN to GitHub. And
We open sourced the back end and everything and put it on SVN.
Right. So first we open everything. We put in. It's been there for a while. Again, SVN didn't quite cut the mustard. But then GitHub, like, it was like, thank you, Linus Torvalds. And it was just an amazing change of phase there that happened. Everybody and their dogs started contributing to the compiler. It was just a watershed. And right now, there's like probably 100 open contributions, and for many, like 7 in the compiler, 20 in the standard library, 10 in the runtime and the documentation. So it's just absolutely amazing the change of phase that's happened there. And it's much easier to integrate changes because of GitHub's innate merging ability and online tools and whatnot. So I would highly recommend to any project, you know, language compiler or whatnot, to actually be there on GitHub, because it's just a huge tool.
In fact, we've just moved all of our open source stuff onto GitHub.
I'm getting scared now.
Here comes Haskell.
So we've got like the whole VM source tree is on GitHub, and a host of other packages that we've written for doing a lot of Web 2.0 stuff. So there's a very nice curl binding that Sigbio did, and some good RSS feed libraries and other things like that, and SQLite 3, and XMLite, and all these other things that we find very useful. And we've had them up on, I think it was code.galois.com for ages. But putting them up on GitHub, we've already got people forking,
amazing.
So it's fantastic.
It completely caught us by surprise how successful using GitHub has been.
Yeah.
It's been astonishing, and we had really no idea.
Yeah, I've heard this again and again.
Isn't that all about kind of reducing friction of consumption again?
Absolutely.
Because if it's like on code.galois.com, how do you find it?
And, yeah, exactly. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
It's 2 button clicks.
Yes.
Somebody contributes a patch. You look at the patch. Okay, 2 button clicks. It's merge.
Yeah. And so how do you kind of, you know, because like, when you're designing a language or like, you know, somebody has to be the kind of benevolent dictator. And is the language design also open to kind of, you know, contributions, or how does that work? Can somebody say, you know, I want to add, you know, I don't know, iterators, so here's like, you know.
We get new proposals every day, and they get debated on in the D forums, and a very small number of them actually make it into the language, because, you know, the whole thing would collapse if we
we
tried to implement them all, of course. So they do go through a vetting process in the community, and, you know, every once in a while we realize we have made a mistake and we deprecate a feature.
But when somebody, like, what I like about, for example, the Python process is where people kind of, it's like a little bit like that there's a barrier to entry where you have to kind of write kind of like a spec of your feature. Is that something that you require as well?
We have the dips. So you know the pips, right?
Yes.
Python improvement.
Yes, exactly.
Proposal.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
We have the dips. You know, just search for dip D language. So, it's out there. It's a wiki that's fairly structured. Dips have essentially the I think the way it works is people discuss on the forums, so we have a very active forum that's, you know, almost a full-time job just to follow, and whatever gets filtered through that forum and, you know, essentially gets enough interest and acquires a critical mass. For example, this very dependency package management and distribution subsystem has been heavily discussed, and there is a dip on it. You know, whatever gets filtered through the C-Lib Charybdis of the news group gets on the dip pages, and we have like probably 16 open or 11 open dips right now. We haven't been great at adopting, keeping track of dips and whatnot, but I think this is part of the growing pains, and you know, as things are going to need to happen, they're going to naturally happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're very much focused on language stability, quality, and much less on growth in features proper. So, standard library, growing the standard library is a priority. The compiler quality is a priority. Having a well-defined language is a priority, which is much. You know, it's actually, Haskell also has had a history of a couple of things that, oh, you know, we didn't think of that kind of stuff. And, you know, Walter and I, coming from a more practical oriented but less academic fashioned background, we have more of those than Haskell does, admittedly. So, because we have more of those, we gotta put extra effort on the implementation, you know, working the kinks out and whatnot. And, you know, this happens in all houses. You know, this happens in all houses. I've seen reports in Haskell, like, you know, I thought, even SPJ himself, he's like, oh, I thought about that the wrong way. And I was wrong, and, you know, I'm correct, I stand correct, and I'm going to fix the things, you know. So definitely things are happening, things are out there. There is a process in place, which is right now is functioning adequately well. I don't see it as a bottleneck in the development of the language. And the main focus right now is more on the language stability route than language growth route in terms of features. And on the language stability, we're doing great because we use Bugzilla. People submit bugs, people work on bugs, people fix bugs. There's GitHub is increasingly getting better, as I'm sure you'll notice, Andy, is increasingly getting better at interoperating with GitHub. So if you annotate your GitHub fix, it automatically closes the bug on Bugzilla. So, you know, it works pretty nicely.
We also have an awesome feature put together by Brad Roberts, which whenever somebody changes something in GitHub, including merging a pull request to the compiler or even proposing a pull request, it will download those to the server and run the full test suite on it. So all you got to do is click on a button and you see all the outstanding pull requests for modifications and whether they pass the test suite or not on each platform.
Okay.
And if it did fail, exactly what failed. So anyone can look at the status of the pull request and go, well, this one obviously needs work because the test case is showing red for it. It's not passing the test.
Nice, yeah.
So included in the pull request also are test suite fixes. So you don't have the excuse that, well, you need to fix the test suite in your pull request. So that was, you know, a major contribution by Brad to automate everything with that. And it makes the integration much smoother and easier. And it also raised the bar for contributions.
Yes,
because, you know, people don't want to submit stuff that doesn't pass. Because, you know, you look bad doing that. There's a lot of peer pressure to make it right. And to have, you know, all your stuff to be green in the autotester. So that's been a huge win for us, the autotesting stuff.
So Andy, what is the latest news on this monomorphism restriction? Talking about language stability.
Actually, I think it may have been, I don't want to say for sure, I think it may have been cut out at GHC7 though. I thought you were going to ask about monad comprehensions.
Yes, well, that's another one. Yeah, list comprehensions.
List comprehensions have always been with us, but monad comprehensions, I think we're in 1.2 or 1.3 only. Because the type error messages were bad enough, but when you've got monad comprehensions in there, it just gets much, much worse.
So I didn't follow, what's the deal with monomorphism? I'm thinking a juice story.
So that's just a juicy story.
So the monomorphism restriction comes in when you have a top level, what we call a CAF, which is basically just a value. It doesn't have any. It's not a function, basically. But if it's something like, say, x equals 1. The problem with 1 in Haskell is that it's overloaded. It can be
Haskell, 1 doesn't have type int, it has type num a to arrow a.
It could be whatnot, yeah.
Yes, that's right. So having a literal like that that actually needs a dictionary in order to... So the monomorphism restriction was to get around that, where you'd have to say, oh, no, that top-level thing I may use an int.
And also because people get confused because they think they kind of bind a value, but because it's really a function that requires a dictionary, it gets recomputed many times.
It's like the source code's lying to you. It's one of these things. N plus K patterns was another controversial one.
Yes,
I think they're gone now.
Yes. Oh, really? I love them.
N plus K patterns, where you could write a function like f of
factorial.
N plus 2 or N plus 3, and it would calculate the... this had to be a constant, didn't it?
N plus K. It has to be a constant. But like, it would be great for demos to write factorial, right? Yeah. Factorial of 0 equals 1, and factorial of n plus 1, beautiful. But yes, that was always controversial.
This is sort of undecidedly typed, or what was the matter?
No, it's just that it just created a whole mess behind the scenes when you're like compiling this data pattern.
This becomes a function or what?
I don't know how it compiled down. Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. Yeah. I use them all the time, and people were
Something
the other
in
one
System
was,
F.
Yes. Yeah. And so what about these twiddles? That's the other...
Lazy pattern matching?
Lazy pattern matching.
Yeah. So where are you?
So now we're going to take all the kind of dirty laundry out here in front of the camera. Yeah. Look at that. Like, talking about, like, is it Perl or Haskell? Yeah.
So this is lazy?
Yes.
So basically, this match is going to succeed no matter what. But essentially, X gets bound to the first of whatever this ends up.
And could it fail dynamically?
Well, it could fail. Yeah, it can fail after that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And this comes from the time before there were monads, when people would write when I/O was modeled with streams.
Yeah.
But then your program was like, what does it a function from?
Responses to requests.
Yes. And then
you would start off with a response.
Exactly. And then you would kind of tie the loop. But there, if your program was too eager, and it kind of you would already send out a response before it had the first request. So you always had to put the twiddles in there.
It was a way of just putting a little bit of a barrier, just a break in the recursion. But it's still useful in some cases. But it's also a potential source of huge space leaks.
Yes.
Space leaks.
Yeah, so if I end up using X at some point and not using Y for a very long time, I'm going to hang on to this computation.
Yeah.
And I think there was even a big space leak in GHC back in like 94. Something that was due to one of these in the wrong place. So we would hang on to the entire program file when it didn't need to.
So the monomorphic restriction is going to be... So essentially you can't write x equals 2 at global level, or top level anymore.
No, I think you can, but it's going to be defaulted to int.
Okay. Alright, so
there's... Yes, so there's flip-flop between, like, should it be monomorphic or polymorphic or...
Right.
Yes. So are there any kind of these kind of, like, does D have any dirty laundry? D laundry?
I think I mentioned earlier about how we made some mistakes.
Yes, sure. You mentioned that, so that's why I kind of...
Let's have some details. Yes, that's what we're saying.
Yeah.
Well, one colossal mistake was thinking I could make a bit type to be a regular type. Okay, bit meaning one bit, not a byte, not a word, or a single bit. So if you had an array of bits, it would naturally work out to be a set. And I thought, that's so cool to have that. And boy, did I try to make that work. And nothing worked right with it. It was like a ripple on a carpet. You could make it work over here, and it would, pop up over there as a result. There was no fixing it.
So why wouldn't that be the same as bool?
Well, it's just one bit inside the word, potentially.
Bool is the whole byte.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be.
Doesn't have to be.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, okay.
The problem is to take its address.
The problem is its address. So then you got in, for the address of a bit, you need a fat pointer. Because you need a pointer
plus an offset,
which bit number it is. Right. And then it became incompatible with the way arrays worked. It became incompatible with this, and you know, it's just.
Yeah. So it wasn't really a fat pointer. A fat pointer is two words. So this was a word and a little. So it could be an overweight pointer.
overweight pointer.
That's about it. A pointer with a couple of extra pounds.
I think I tried for two years to make that work, and finally we just said this is not working, and we just ripped the whole thing out.
Yeah. So does everything in D have an address then?
Yes. Pointers are pointers. Well, I should back up a bit. You have pointers, and then you have fat pointers, which are two words. And the fat pointers, there are several varieties of them. One are delegates. Delegate is really a pair. It's a pointer and it's a pointer to the function plus a pointer to the data.
That's very much like the delegate in C#.
Yes. Yeah. And the other one are arrays. Arrays consist of a pointer and a length. It's a pair. And so
strings. Are strings arrays of characters or are they their own type?
Arrays of immutable characters.
Yeah. We
singly linked lists of
one
characters.
Of the original, one of the original design goals is I didn't want strings to be a magic separate type. They had to be arrays. They had to have array semantics. And I think we succeeded with that. There's no difference between a string and an array of immutable characters.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. It's like, you know, in Haskell, right, the string doesn't really exist, right? It's just a list of characters.
Right. But there are moves afoot to do something different there. So there's this.
I kind of return to the Haskell?
Oh, absolutely.
You should never have left.
There's this string class, which is a means of giving many different representations to string. It's actually really convenient to think of a string as a list of characters, just because Haskell is really good at lists, basically. You know, we have lots and lots and lots of libraries and functions and things. But at some point, you know, you'd need to also sometimes think of strings as like packed arrays of chars or whatever. And that's what the byte string library is able to do for us.
But don't you then get into this whole mess with Unicode and, you know, whatever, encodings and things like that?
Most of that's taken care of by data.char in Haskell, I think. And I'm relying on Simon Marlowe's implementation of all that sort of stuff. That's very tricky, though, especially when you've got Unicode points that don't correspond to real things and all those things.
D resolves that by having a separate char type from a byte data type. Mm. Okay, it's actually typed differently, and what a char type actually is in D is a UTF-8 code point. Mm-hmm. So all strings are UTF-8 strings or in D, and it's all how you interpret the string. You can interpret it as an array of bytes, or you can interpret it as a decoded UTF-8 string. And it works out surprisingly well, and it's very efficient because you can always treat it like an array of code points when that's more efficient, or treat it like an array of decoded characters when that's more efficient.
Is that conversion implicit?
When you're using loops, it is implicit. Otherwise, there's a library function to move them back and forth.
Mm-hmm. And actually, we have a nice method in standard library, which me as the theoretically inclined guy wrote. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's a function that's called representation, and give it a string, which is an array of code. I think code units is the word, not code points. What's unit? What's point?
I keep getting units. Mixed up. Which
code units would be the actual eight bits, right?
Okay. Yeah. So that's right. That's
array of code units, and you get back an array of U byte, which is the unsigned byte. It's like the absolutely rawest
word 32.
And so you get you call representation against a string, and you retype it. Essentially, it's a no op. Technically, you retype it from an array of code points, units, into an array of bytes. And then you can manipulate it as an array of bytes with absolutely no encumbrance. And then you get to either verify it and it throws an exception if anything's wrong, or you go on faith and cast it back to an array of characters, and that's how it works. Mm. So at some level, there are ways in D to break the type system. So it's good up until the first cast. It's type safe up until the first cast.
Again, Haskell, good until the first unsafe performer.
Unsafe coerce.
Yes.
Right. So, speaking of dirty laundry and such, so Bit was sort of an interesting... and second, we have, D has had this huge ambition of making these two worlds functional, which is means like pure functions, means mm-hmm. immutable data, and means with the dirty world of I'm going to mutate data, I'm mm-hmm. going to cast data, I want to look at the same mm-hmm. data through different lenses, different mm-hmm. types, and for the most part we succeeded, and I believe we are in very good shape. But there are a few type checks in constructing things is difficult.
Yes, right.
Like starting from the sort of the untyped world and getting to a type world. I'm not sure if in Haskell you can even easily express, I want to build a doubly linked list. Is that doable?
You probably have a data. It depends what sort of behavior do you want from that data structure? What are the important operations?
The primitives are the typical doubly linked list. I can go forward and back.
Yeah. So I think what you would have to do then is do cons list and snock list.
Yes.
And you just keep the second
cons list and snock list. They are reverse lists. So you kind of take two lists and then you kind of
move.
So this is reverse. Okay.
Yes.
This is kind of a
typical Haskell thing where,
this
is probably Snell or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
Lynn.
So this is a primitive. It's sort of a primitive in the language, right?
What? No, list is defined the same way in the prelude essential.
Right, but the thing is, can you actually build it with the layout of a typical?
You're not going to get exactly the same thing.
Right,
but there's probably some way of doing it that I'm not capable of doing.
The ambition here is so you have typically doubling. Uh-huh. This would be the payload, and this would be the back pointer, and this would be the forward pointer, mm-hmm. right? And you have two of these guys, right?
Yeah.
So then, how do you at the same time construct several of these nodes and fix the pointers such that they point both these ways? So this is a mutation issue.
I would ask you a different question.
Uh-huh.
What are the algorithms and things that you're wanting to use this? Why do you need this doubly linked structure? And then I'd see about is there something about the algorithm that we can express in some sort of higher order computation that gives you the right sort of behavior? That's the way you'd go about it.
Exactly the kind of way you would do it. You would kind of design from the kind of the requirements of the algorithm.
You don't work up from the data. It's much more about from the function.
But I think we're in the room.
And it was getting interesting.
Yes, we're
not over yet.
Let me go on record here. I was about to destroy here. Okay.
You already knew the answer.
I was just about to destroy too. We were both just about to destroy.
We were going down your
memory. Chickened out, man.
All right, this is great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks, Andy.
Good, look at this.
Thanks.
Yes, Ian Haskell.
And of course,
Charles. World peace.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Charles rocks.
Yes. World peace.
Right on.
We're going to get destruction.
Hi, Mom.
That was fun.